take it away, Arnessa.
Thank you, Amelia, and thank you for organizing this wonderful panel. I am so excited to be here. It's really, you know, fitting that this conference is being held at this place and in this time when, you know, not only our planet is under threat, but what we do is under threat from forces inside and outside. So we have a great panel to talk about this, what journalism looks like in the future from all perspectives, visual journalists and TV journalists and people working with journalism in the community and at the academic level. So I'm going to just kind of get out of the way and start introducing our excellent panel here, and they'll give a brief kind of introduction to what they do, and then we'll have a discussion, and you'll be able to ask some questions. The first person I'd like to introduce is Roop Raj. Roop anchors the local news at Fox 2 in Detroit. He began his career in Troy, son of the Midwest, and he has also worked in one of my favorite cities, New Orleans, where he broadcasted and won awards for his coverage during Hurricane Katrina. Roop.
I bring my phone with me so that I can time exactly what 5 minutes looks like, because I'm a TV guy, and we don't want to go over, otherwise our mics will get cut, right? It's important that we respect your time, because the fact that you came all this way to the great city of Flint, and I say great because I worked here myself back in 98 until 2002, this is such a special place in this world. And the universe is here to tell us something. Flint, Detroit, cities like it that have gone through tough times and continue to struggle are here because they're supposed to teach the world a lesson. And how dare we, as the world, turn our cheek, turn our heads to a city like Flint? How dare we? I say that because we did over and over again. My name is Roop Raj. I'm an anchor and reporter in Detroit at the Fox affiliate there. You know, it was 2016 that I walked by a newsstand and I saw Newsweek magazine. And the headline on the cover said, "Is Detroit making you sick?" And it was all about the environmental issues that are happening in southwest Detroit, which is an area of blue-collar, low-income people who are working their tails off in the shadows of refineries. And those refineries, the emissions so bad that the Newsweek article actually said it's like sucking on a tailpipe to live in that area. How dare we turn our cheek to that? Tonight, or today rather, we're here to say, shoulder by shoulder, we're not here to turn our cheek. We're here to face it, look at it, examine it, talk about it, tell stories about it, and make sure it should never happen again. That's why you're here today. That's why you do what you do. And that's why we show up each and every day to work. It is a privilege and an honor to be with you today. You know, I mentioned that I started my career in Lansing, Michigan, but within 2 years, I got a job offer in Flint. It was 1998. And I got to come work in a newsroom and tell the story of a great blue-collar city of shuttered factories and, yes, shuttered dreams, but not at all without a spirit that had been closed down. The spirit of this great city continues to just thrive even in the face of adversity. You know, I just read the article and tweeted this morning to my followers out in Detroit that we should continue to pay attention to what's happening in Flint. And it shouldn't be because someone like Elon Musk just decided, by the way, to provide water filters to all Flint schools. And that is something we can all applaud to, I think, right now. Elon Musk decides to do that. Now, that's great. But that shouldn't be the only time that I tweet about it or that you write about it. And I know that's not the only time. We write about the environment because the environment happens, the stories of the environment happen between the big headlines that the big papers and the big TV stations catch. Your job and my job is to tell the stories each and every day of this struggle. You know, I lived in New Orleans for almost 8 years, and my time there was spent covering 24 tropical systems. Many of them were hurricanes, some of them were tropical storms. Hurricane Lily, followed by Tropical Storm Isidore in 2002, I stood on I-10 with water up to my waist, wondering how in this world this is happening. I was premature in asking the question because 23, 24 storms later, I just shook my head. And during Hurricane Gustav in 2008 in the Emergency Operations Center, with Sanjay Gupta of CNN and others from the network who, as you or someone poignantly said, parachuted in to tell this story, this was my home. It was Louisiana. My wife is born and brought up there. Her parents' house was flooded. I lost friends in Katrina. We lost people from suicide. We lost people because they lost their homes, and I knew people who drowned and never came back. And I asked myself on that awful, awful day, and by the way, it wasn't August 29th, 2005, that was the worst of times for the city of New Orleans. That was actually a really optimistic day. The sun came out. We emerged on Canal Street, looked at the street, walked through the French Quarter, noticed there was probably about a foot of water, and we thought, wow, we dodged the bullet, as famously was said by a radio commentator on our transistor radio that we were listening to. And with a satellite phone, we called each other to say it's going to be okay, only to start heading east. And as we continued to head east past the French Quarter, we noticed that in the Ninth Ward, water was rising and rising and rising until we discovered there were people on the rooftops. I waved my head again and asked the question, how in God's name do we let this happen? How do we let this happen? And so when we talk about coastal erosion, when we talk about the story of Louisiana, we talk about the story of Detroit, we talk about the story of Flint, the sickest and saddest part of all of it is that each and every one of us knew that it was happening. Somebody knew that coastal erosion would cause this to happen. Someone knew that levee walls built of peanut brittle probably wouldn't sustain something that was past a Category 3. So for 35 to 40 years, people like Mary Landrieu, the senator out of Louisiana, whose brother led the city for so many years, went to Washington and asked them to do something. Nothing happened. And then the storm hit. Let us not wait for the next storm. Let us begin now to tell the stories. It's our role, our duty, and really, it's our responsibility to do that each and every day. Covering the environment isn't just for environmental journalists, it's for all journalists. And dare we turn our cheek to this important topic? I'm glad we're starting the conversation here. Thanks for having me. By the way, that was 5 minutes and 2 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you, Rook. Next, I would like to introduce Tawana Petty. She also works in Detroit. She's the Data Justice Coordinator with the Detroit Community Technology Project, where she looks at issues such as the digital divide, which is important to us, and media literacy. She is tasked with trying to demystify data and make it more accessible to more people. Well, you could start with me, Tawana. She's also a poet, so if you look her up online, you'll see some of her beautiful poetry.
I'm gonna sit if that's okay. Is this on? First of all, thank you. I'm so honored to be here. And also, I'm really grateful for the way that Rook started this conversation this morning. I'm normally the one who's the heavy, who starts off with that perspective. So I'm really grateful that I can go second in doing that. And so I think it's very important that when we're thinking about environment and we're thinking about journalism, that we are thinking about environmental racism and how that drives some of the media images and the narrative that is plaguing some of our cities. And so a lot of times we're reporting on the impact of those things, but we're not thinking about how systemic the narrative and the media images are in creating some of the conditions that we're reporting on. And so I'm from Detroit. I've been there my entire life, and I'm 42 years old, and I can say that for most of my life, with the exception of maybe about 5 years, that my city has suffered under really a weight of propaganda assault. Detroit has essentially been the running joke of the country for about 50 years. And so, you know, you think about the 20-somethings or the 30-somethings or even younger who have only seen negative media images about the city that they've been raised in, or have only seen negative media, music, television, and just spurts of positive media images. And so some of the ways that within my work, I serve as a data justice coordinator for Detroit Community Technology Project. I also co-founded a magazine called Riverwise Magazine, which is stories of Detroiters by Detroiters. And I also serve as a member of Detroit Digital Justice Coalition. And what we do is we offer up the opportunities for community members to have an opportunity to tell their stories, to bring them into the fold, those that don't have access to the internet, because Detroit, 38% of the city doesn't have access to the internet. You wouldn't think that in a major city, that almost half of the city doesn't have access to the internet. So when we're talking about a digital technological age, we're leaving out a lot of the people in the equation, mostly those that are poor and working class or less than working class because they don't have jobs. And so what we do is we organize what's called data discotheques, discotheque being a play on words for short for discovering technology. And these are technology fairs where we organize them in all the different districts of the city, and we have community members and representatives from the city who man stations to teach things about, like, the open data portal. Like, how many in this room know that there's an open data portal in your city? By show of hands. So there is over 2,600 open data portals in the United States, and these open data portals have access to community information, emergency response, recreation centers, what development is happening in your city, crime data, and different things like that. And most people don't even know that those open data portals exist, except developers, who somehow got the information and are able to purchase property from wherever they live and parachute into cities that are suffering under crisis and purchase up all that land. And so it's important that we, as people who demystify data, bring community members into the fold so they can be empowered to have not only have access to this data, but to use this data for their best interests. I also serve as a data justice researcher for our Data Bodies Project, which is a three-city participatory research project that thinks about the impact that our data has on our communities. So if you think about walking into this room today, all of the different things that you've interacted with that has extracted your data, whether it be your name badge, whether it be your license plate, whether it be your driver's license and the information that you gave out to access a driver's license, the information that you gave out to get your gym membership, the information that you gave out to register for a conference, you have to trust that the entities that receive your data are going to use it for good. Well, that's not always the case. And so, in order to demystify data, we educate people on what you're giving away. It's not just Facebook. It's not just the data that's extracted on facial recognition. It's all the information that we carry with us everywhere we go, and the information that we loosely give out in our communities. And so, I'll leave it there. But that's a lot of the ways that we demystify data and bring community members into the fold as not an afterthought, but as the experts of their experience in their communities.
Thank you. Next, thank you, Tawana. That was great. Next, I'd like to introduce Emmett Smith. He's a creative director at National Geographic, where he recently oversaw a complete redesign of the magazine to give its visual journalism even stronger impact. So, and if you follow Nat Geo online as well, you know they are the host of some innovative, interactive, outstanding journalism on the environment and the planet. So I'll let you talk about visual journalism.
I'm going to go ahead and stand up. Since everyone else is establishing their Michigan bona fides, I feel like I should do mine too. I was born in Ann Arbor and started my career as an intern for the Detroit Free Press, so has a great soft spot in my heart. It's interesting to be here today sort of representing National Geographic and talking about the future of news. National Geographic was founded in 1888. We've been doing this for, you know, more than 130 years now. It's almost sort of unimaginable within our walls that there wouldn't be a future of news, and scary to think about. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we're tackling this. But first I want to talk about another publication. On my way out here, I picked up the 25th anniversary edition of Wired magazine. It blows my mind that Wired is 25 years old at this point. They've been spending 25 years sort of declaring the end of everything, the end of people, the end of advertising, the end of animals, just like you name it, they have tried to end it. And news, of course, is one of those things. But the thing about it is even with sort of all of their optimism on what technology will and won't do and what the future will be built with that technology, it never actually ends anything. I think sort of like the great example that most of us understand is, you know, Napster came in, it sort of mortally wounded the music industry, and then the government killed Napster. But then so these music companies then partnered with, you know, iTunes and other things and came up with this thing that was new, but you still could get music. People could still get paid for recording music. And in this way, you know, technology changed the way that we consumed music, but it didn't end music. And I think that, you know, it's not going to end news. It's just going to change the way in which we consume it. As Wired got everything wrong over the last 25 years, none of us in here have any idea what the future of news looks like. But it's imperative that we all get into the sandbox and figure it out together. The stories are too important to let go and to not figure out, you know, what is that iTunes solution or what is that sort of new way that we're going to get it. And so at National Geographic, we are everywhere. We're in a magazine. We're on television. We're on Snapchat. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Reddit. Oh, Lord, where else are we? We're playing with AR and VR. And I don't know that any of these things are going to be around in 3 years. You know, Facebook just nuked their news feed, so who knows where that's headed. But I do know that as all of these smart people are building all of these new platforms, some of them are going to succeed, and these are the ways in which we're going to get the stories that you guys do and the stories that we do that are so vitally important to average, regular, everyday people who don't necessarily have the voices to tell them out there. And that audience is hugely important. One of the stories we did recently, which is not an environmental story, but an excellent example of how we are playing with platforms, we did our September cover on a young woman named Katie Stubblefield, who was the youngest person ever to receive a full facial transplant. And from the beginning, you know, we spent, you know, 2 years photographing that story, and from the beginning, we talked about what will this look like in the magazine, what will this look like on television. You know, we had Snapchat editions on teen suicide. You know, we were everywhere and talking about how do we get what we believe is an incredibly important story out to as many people as possible in the ways in which they want to consume it. It's a really sort of audience empathetic view of how you publish a story, because I think too often we sit inside our walls of our newspapers and our magazines and our websites and say, well, this is what would work for us, this is how we're going to monetize this, this is how, you know, we can keep this going. But at the end of the day, you really have to think about how is your consumer, how is your reader, how do they want to come to you, what's the path of least resistance for them. Because if we're all busy, and if you don't work in a newspaper, you probably interact with news on your Apple News feed, and that's about it every day. So how do we get these stories to them? And so from the very beginning, we kept the core story team of the photo editor, the text editor, the graphics editors, the photographers, and the reporter in constant contact with all these people that manage all of these platforms for us. And so, you know, we launched this magazine with this story. And in the first month, it gets almost 700 million total views across all platforms, which is, even for us, just a massive success. And I think that sort of the key to that, to the 500 million social views, the 4 million Apple News reads, the 4 million reads on the O&O, the 20 million views on our YouTube channel, was keeping the core storytellers, the reporters, in contact and not just handing that story off, but letting them own it really across all of the platforms. And when you do that and you have something that breaks through like The Face, or you have something that breaks through for us like Plastics did, which is a joint sort of effort between the magazine, between our television channel, and between our not-for-profit society side, you get one of these sort of moments of serendipity, like a magazine cover that really breaks through and goes viral and gets people paying attention. And we're ready with, you know, things like a pledge where the people can sign up for, and advice and tips and tricks on how they can reduce their single-use plastics. And we're there no matter how you're coming to us on any platform to give you that information that we think you need to know. It's not just, hey, we have this thing, go buy our magazine. It's, we think this story is important, and we're going to bring it to you everywhere. And in a year, we're going to bring it to you in an entirely different way. I don't know what that way is going to look like, but I know that we're going to be in all of the sandboxes trying to figure that out, because I don't know what the future of news is, but I'm militantly optimistic about it, because the alternative is sort of unthinkable. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to introduce Terry Perez. He's the Deputy Editor of Engagement at ProPublica. And I'm sorry I didn't mention your Detroit bona fides, but you do have Detroit bona fides. You also worked at WDET, the NPR affiliate in Detroit. And you've been a leader, ProPublica has, in crowdsourcing everything from investigations into maternal mortality to bias in Facebook ads. So this panel brings you a wealth of information from different sides.
I'm from Garden City, Michigan. I went to Wayne State University, and I had my car broken into a few times, so I guess those are my Detroit. No, I'm just kidding. So, I love this city. I left when I was 31. I went to Oakland, California. I loved it so much that I came back. But then I had a job at ProPublica, and it was a dream job, so I left for that gig. The future of news, that's the name of this panel, right? I have no fucking idea what the future of news is. If someone does, please raise their hand. It changes every year. We're talking about platforms. We're talking about virtual reality. We're talking about Instagram, the Facebook algorithm. It's changing. We're wringing our hands about Facebook traffic and all of these things. I do think that the one constant, though, is people and community. And I think that's a really important thing to think about, that there is a thing called an audience that we're trying to reach, and there are readers, and there are listeners, and there are viewers. But there's a thing called community, and those are the people that we're writing about, and those are the people that are impacted by the things that we report on. And that doesn't change. All of the ways we reach people and display our websites and all of the different innovative strategies that we have, and like put a camera on a drone and do a thing with it. I mean, that's going to change 2 years from now, 4 years from now, 10 years from now. It's all going to be different. 10 years ago, we were doing things we're doing things now. 10 years ago, I couldn't even have thought of. But the one sort of through line is that we were focusing our stories on people and trying to include them in our reporting, and trying to give them an avenue and a place and a spot to share and participate and contribute. And that's what I was doing at WDET. That's what I was doing at my first job at the Hamtramck Citizen, which is now closed, which was a weekly, the old 75-year-old weekly in Hamtramck, which is a small enclave of the city of Detroit. That's how I got this. That's what I'm doing at ProPublica, is making sure with all of the data, beautiful data, news apps, interactives that we do, trying to figure out the best way in which the community can participate in what we do. So generally that ends up being crowdsourcing, right? Generally that ends up finding a story that has some sort of victim, and a victim doesn't necessarily have to be, a single person who has, discriminated against or perpetrated upon by some assailant, but the victim could be the American people and how Wall Street has destroyed their homes and their savings and all of these things. And so finding ways of those who have stories, of those who feel harmed, of those who feel ignored, and trying to create avenues for them to participate. Generally, that can be like structured forms or crowdsourced forms or WhatsApp, texting into us. But there's all different types of technologies, and there's all different types of ways for them to participate. But one of the things that we do at ProPublica on my team is taking very seriously where these folks are. How do they communicate with each other? How do they pass information back and forth? Not necessarily how do they find ProPublica and how do they follow ProPublica and how do they sign up to our newsletters, but where are they where are they talking to each other? How do they talk to each other? And figuring out a way to proactively reach out to them, get them to be part of our story, and then on the back end, how do we make our story resonate within that community? I think one last thing I'll say is I think that for investigative reporting for a long time has been this idea of somebody, you know, locked up in a room somewhere with a stack of documents, and they publish a story, and the first thing that anybody sees about this story is 25,000 words or 10,000 words or, you know, 1,000 words or whatever it might be. And I think one of the things that we try to do and flip and change at ProPublica is, how do we do this out in the open? How do we let people know we're reporting about something before we drop this enormous story that maybe they'll read 25% of it, right? So, like, asking questions first, asking people to participate in our maternal harm project, asking people to participate in our Agent Orange exposure project, asking people to participate in our age discrimination stories prior to pushing out just the findings and the stories or whatever, making sure that we create a way to listen for participation. Participation and for contribution, it will only make our journalism, and it doesn't even have to be investigative, but our journalism richer, stronger, deeper, and potentially, hopefully, fingers crossed, resonate in the community in a different way. Thanks.
Thank you. And lastly, I'll introduce, we'll raise the academic level of our conversation, Florian Schwab. He's assistant professor at the School of Information at the University of Michigan, where he studies and researches the intersection of humans and computers, with a particular focus on privacy and security, which are issues that are becoming more important in the media landscape today. Florian.
Good morning, everybody. So I'm kind of the outlier on this panel. I'm a computer scientist, I'm a professor, but I'm really glad to be here and talk with all of you about the future of news. Okay. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with what a school of information is. I have to say I wasn't until about a couple of years ago. What we do at the School of Information is we study people, information, and technology, and particularly the implications of technology and information on people's lives. So we're studying the implications, and we're enabling our students, as well as through our research, our communities, to really use technology for a betterment of the world rather than to the detriment. That's our mission, at least, right? Personally, my research is at the intersection of human-computer interaction. So how do people interact with technology in all kinds of different settings? And in particular, how does it intersect with questions of privacy or security? So some of my research has focused on studying privacy behavior of undocumented immigrants. How are they trying to protect themselves? Are they effective at keeping their identity or their status to themselves? And the tensions that arise when you introduce technology into that mix, and when you have mixed status families where some children might have legal status in the country, others don't. We've done research on how people react to data breaches. Right? So many of you have probably heard of the Equifax data breach that happened last year, affected millions of people. We talked to people afterwards and found that a large percentage of people had not protected themselves afterwards. They didn't place credit freezes, took any kind of other measures. So we tried to analyze what's the reason for that. Right? What are the impediments that prevent people from doing that? And what we found is that there's often a confusion of what is actually the best way of protecting yourself. And even if you know what it is, how do you go about that? And then there are equity questions regarding cost. Until the end of September, it costs you money to place a credit freeze. That has finally changed. I'm also interested in privacy, right? So how do we communicate much of the news really everything is moving into the digital realm, and how do we communicate what data is being collected about people, for what purposes, how is that data being used? Who of you here has read a privacy policy? Can you raise your hand? Like in the last month? The whole thing? Right? At least you looked at it, right? So yeah, right? Like we're under no illusion that anyone reads privacy policies, but yet at the same time we claim that having a privacy policy creates transparency. and you're all in the business of informing people, right? So you know that claiming transparency is not the same as actually informing people about what's going on. So that's something we're studying. We're thinking about how can we move this information actually better into the interaction with technology? Can we integrate short notices about things that are surprising or unexpected into how you interact with Facebook and other services so that you're informed about that, right? As well as give people control. Now, one thing where this intersects with news and reporting and journalism is that much of our news are now delivered online through different channels, right? Terry talked a lot about the different ways they're looking at, so did Emmett. And one of the aspects of this is that we often have advertising. Advertising is a big part of the revenue model for much of the news industry. And I'm not opposed to advertising per se, but what I'm opposed to, or what we have an issue with, is the amount of tracking that goes into targeting advertising. Right? So really, when you go to a news site today or you open Instagram, there are many entities that keep track of what articles I'm reading, what I'm looking at, and they're using that to create profiles about me, inferring all kinds of information from whether I'm in the market for a new car. They might know that I just bought a house last year, right? And they use that to then target advertising. But I think what's really scary is that studies have found that the news platforms, the websites, often don't even know who these trackers are that are on their platform. And that's due to the way the ad ecosystem works online. Right, so to make this a little bit more specific, I took the liberty to look up our panelists' websites today. And what we found is, so what I looked at, so fox2detroit.com, right, has 23 trackers on the website, 15 of which are ad trackers. Right, National Geographic has 28 trackers on the website. 16 of those are ad trackers. ProPublica, not quite as bad, 8 trackers.
Right. How many?
8. Just for comparison, the New York Times, 26 trackers on the website. Right. And there's really a question, like, is it really necessary that over 20 different entities learn which article I'm reading and which articles I click on, how much of the article I'm reading? Right. Probably not. So I think there's also some kind of disingenuity in this, right? Like, we can't claim that people are really aware of this. Yes, people know that, you know, ads are necessary to finance news to some extent, and I think that's a willing trade-off many people are, or a trade-off people are willing to make, but this kind of covert tracking that is going on of the behavior is really problematic. And an interesting aspect of this is that big companies like Google and Facebook have actually a really complete picture of what you like and who you are, and they probably might know you better than even your family members, right? Because they're pretty much present on every website we visit. So my challenge for you today, and maybe for the future of news, is also to rethink how we engage with our readers, right? The goal is to inform the readers and have a trust relationship with readers. I think credibility is a big important aspect of the news conversation going forward, and I think that should start with respecting people's privacy. So I think we need to think about how can we combine revenue models that are potentially ad-based or different revenue models with ways that are less privacy invasive and more respectful of the reader. Thank you.
Thank you. So, an excellent panel, right, from so many perspectives. And I kind of just want to get the conversation started before turning it over to you guys. I'm sure you have many questions that were from issues that were raised here. But going back to what you last said about advertising models, I think that has become something that many news organizations are trying to figure out. But more than that, when it comes to stories, is there a future for long-form, investigative, narrative journalism in this age where we've got to pay for it in some kind of way?
I guess I have to answer that, right, since I work at ProPublica? Well, I said this on the call, and I'll say this again. I surely hope so, because I need a job. But, I mean, I don't know, like, I think that there is a future for journalism that is, you know, hard-hitting and tells a story and it has accountability. I don't necessarily think it always has to be long-form journalism. I think that there will probably always be a space in the world for long-form journalism as a business model. I'm not a business guy. As a business model, the reason ProPublica exists is because IT teams across the country were shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and so there was a gap in investigative. There is great local investigative reporting. There's incredible investigative reporting still to this day across the country, but the reality is the IT teams are shrinking, and so you know, we exist as a nonprofit. We exist on donations from large, from foundations and large donors and small donors. And, you know, that's a sort of a hard business model to get into. But, you know, I think one of the things is, you know, particularly on my team is finding a better way to distribute some of these long form investigative pieces. The reality is we know that people don't read all of the way through. We know that people don't finish 10,000 words. We know that some do. Some stories are better than others, where 60% might read to the bottom. But the reality is, scroll depth on these stories is 50%. And so, you know, I think that one of the, and also, the other thing is that I do think long-form investigative reporting can sometimes be not for the people in which we are writing about. It can be more of a narrative for somebody to read in The New Yorker. But if we're writing about undocumented workers and chicken feed plants in Ohio, do they have New Yorker subscriptions? And there's some information in these subscriptions.
Yeah, that's a question that, Tawana, you kind of raised. People's access to this kind of journalism. Do you feel like there's something that we're missing there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's this conditioning that we're all being forced into. As someone who works for Detroit Community Technology Project, I'm probably wrong in saying this, but I think that our fascination with the internet has really harmed us. And so now we have journalism that's racing to be 140 characters, that's racing to be quick videos, that's racing for views and things like that. And it really is marginalizing a lot of people. And so I think that we need to fall in love again with the physical magazine and physical newspapers and physical books. And we have to fight for that, especially in an age where net neutrality is under attack. And so I think that I think because our information online is going to be so censored in a way, and we're going to only be able to see the things that people who have power and money are going to be able to feed us, the news and information that we're going to be fed. It's really important that we pay respect to long-form journalism, and we pay respect to newspapers and articles, and kind of look at the old style of journalism as the future and not the past.
Well, Ahmed, I think that kind of segues to you, because National Geographic is kind of doing both. And at a recent trivia night, I learned that National Geographic actually has more subscribers than People magazine. So you guys are doing something right. And how do you balance that? The you know, maintaining the quality of the print product while pushing to new things to engage new audiences.
I mean, we're blessed with a 130-year history, and so there we go. We're blessed with a 130-year history, and so we have a huge subscriber roll that sort of buttresses us against some of those pressures. But we're feeling the same pressures that everybody is. And as much as I would love a future where we all fall back in love with print magazines, you know, I don't think that trend line is gonna magically reverse. And so I think if what we care about is long-form investigative narrative journalism, I mean, that's a lot of words, and I think we're going to have to pick some of those. If we're too in love with the long form, we're going to lose the investigative and the journalism. And for me, those are the most important two words in that sort of four-word word soup there. And I think it's any form investigative journalism and on any platform. And however that information gets to the people who can change policy, the people who it affects, that's what we've got to be willing to do. And perhaps not be as enamored with, you know, the 15,000 word piece with our name at the top of it. I would say that the one way to get people to read those at more than a 50% scroll depth is great photography, but I'm biased there.
Definitely. I'm going to ask a couple more questions, but people can start lining up at the microphones. If you have questions, there are microphones at that level and that level. Please start lining up. Ruth, this is something that you mentioned. Underlying this concern about news is the knowledge that we have a lot of data on what our readers want. And we can give them more of that, or we can give them something different. But how we're using this data, do you think we have looked into that enough? And I kind of want to get your opinion and then go to Florian.
Well, I think, you know, obviously at the television station I work at, they have a research team and they look at data, and we have people who look at the metrics of who watches and sees which story and what they like and what they don't like. I'm really proud to say that, you know, when I interviewed for the job here in Detroit, down the road in Detroit, I told my boss something that I'm really proud of. And I just recently did a TED Talk the other day, and I made this part of my script. And I said, I was rejected from the very TV station I applied to 6 times. And the reason I was rejected 6 times is because I wasn't being authentic. I wasn't being myself in these interviews. And one of the things I always wanted to talk about is the legacy of awards and Emmy awards and ratings and how important ratings are to me. And I really think it's important for us to understand the demographics and blah, blah, blah. And ultimately, during my 6th interview, I walked in and looked at the general manager and said, I don't care about Emmys. I really don't care about ratings. That's your job. You're in charge of doing that. I'm a storyteller. I'm a journalist, and that's what I'm going to do. And I kid you not, there was a moment in that job interview in 2009 where I realized I got the job. And I got the job for the first time because I told them, look, I really don't want to sit here and stare at data to determine what I'm going to do that day. So I'm proud to tell you that today, in the last year, I anchor the 5:30 and 6:30 p.m. news. I don't check in with any of the managers. I pick a story, and I go do it, and it shows up on TV. No metrics, no data, nothing. I do the stories because I know that it's important in the community. I love doing speaking engagements, plugging in, finding out what's going on, and then I set up stories. I have one set up today with a Detroit family that's getting, there's a neighborhood re-improvement project that's happening in Detroit, and I met this family at a speaking engagement, and they said, we're really excited because my kids finally get a park. I said, well, how do they get the money? It came from the grant money. What grant money? The chamber, what's the chambers? I call the chamber. And so today, at 12:30 today, I'm going to go sit down and go to this park where they're building this park for this family. I'm going to talk to the kids. I don't care if that gets a lot of hits or not, but I know it will. But my managers are in charge of that. So I'm kind of this rogue guy who's running around just doing stories every day. And until one day they call me in the office and say, you got to go do stories more based on data, I'm not going to change that. And it seems to be working so far. But we also have the luxury of being the number one station in Detroit. People have a habit of watching Channel 2 already. So if I was working at a number 3 station, I don't know if I wouldn't be driven by data.
But data is a two-way street, as Florian pointed out, looking at our websites, that, you know, it's not only the data we can see, but others can see. And so you mentioned that maybe the audience is getting a little bit more concerned about their security and their data and how it's being used. How should news organizations respond to that?
Yeah, I think there needs to be more deliberation about what is actually the information we as a news organization need, right? So that's kind of the analytics piece. And then how do we use that? Should that drive the content generation, or is it more of an informative piece that goes into, like, okay, how does our mix of stories and reporting affect or reach our readership, right, viewership? I think the other aspect, though, is that a lot of this tracking that comes with advertising is just taken for granted, right? Like, the ad industry says, this is how we need to do it. So everyone says, like, okay. And I think it really requires rethinking the relationship you as a journalist want to have with your readers or with your viewers, right? And
do you think at some point consumers will just start voting with their eyeballs and go to places? I mean, obviously, you can track how many ad trackers on a site. Is transparency part of the solution?
I don't think transparency is just the part is the only part there, right? Because you If I go to any news website's privacy policy, it says that they share data with advertisers, but they're not saying I'm sharing it with these 25 advertisers for this purpose. And they couldn't put that in the privacy policy because they don't know. The way it works is you basically contract with an ad network, the ad network brings in the ads, and then each ad brings its own ad trackers with it, other companies that create these profiles. And that just seems like unnecessary to some extent, right? Like, I think some of the news organizations could actually become probably their own advertising networks in a sense and cut out the middlemen to some extent and at the same time reduce this problem with trust with the reader and the viewer. And so I think right now there's just a lot of the ad economy is happening in the dark, and we're not just going to get there by making things more transparent. I think one thing that I find a bit concerning is that we see more of these anti-ad blocker warnings, right? And I use ad blockers. I use ad blockers not because I don't want to support the news websites I go to. I use it because I want to protect myself against malware, and I want to protect myself against being tracked by all these entities, right? So I think divorcing this tracking from the ad question is an important piece of the puzzle.
Okay, we have a question from the audience. Please state your name and where you're from.
Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist from Northern Ohio. Recently, of course, we've seen a lot of nonprofit media grow as for-profit media has shrunk. My question is, what does the panel think about the future of those two different approaches to funding journalism? And is the nonprofit model really viable in the long run?
Well, let's turn to nonprofit model. Terry.
Sure. As deputy editor of engagement, let me talk about our business practices. As somebody who works in development for ProPublica or has worked in fundraising, I can only speak about what I think, and I believe that it's not easy, right? If you think about nonprofit media, and I think if you think about starting a nonprofit, let's say you get a large grant, starting a nonprofit media organization, you get a large grant for that 1 year, you work for that 1 year, and then you have to spend a lot of time looking for money for that second year. Then you have to spend a lot of time looking for money for that third year. One of the ways that ProPublica was able to sort of buck that was they were given a large amount of money to last 5 years, and that is, you know, that is sort of a dream situation. It's really hard to, I would imagine, it's really hard to, get large foundations and large donors, and essentially what I'm talking about is rich people to fund a long-term sustainable project. I mean, there's us, there's the Texas Tribune, you know, Marshall Project to a lesser extent. There's CIR, which has been around since the 70s. And then you start seeing sort of some of these small, like the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting and the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, and they're much smaller. And I don't know how, you know, what their sort of donation practices are and what their donors look like. I'm sure that they're much smaller and plus foundations. But, you know, it's all of it is hard. And I don't know what I can't sit here and say, like, well, this is the best way to do that. I think that there are things to think about. Like most of media is commercial organizations, and that's where most of the jobs are, or shrinking. I mean, there's less and less jobs there, but there's a small number of nonprofits that are growing. And I think that you're starting to see, or you can see, that there is more interest from foundations to think about different types of funding models, right? Different types of grants and whatever to support different types of reporting. Even for us, we've got a grant to support local investigative reporting across the country, where we give or we sort of pay for the salary and benefits of a reporter in a news organization to cover something for the entire year. That money goes to that reporter, that frees up that reporter at that news organization, but they don't lose somebody because then they can hire someone else. You know, so that's an interesting way to sort of inject more investigative reporting into a local environment, that I don't have an answer. I'm just, at this point, I'm just rambling. But, like, I don't know, right? I don't know the smartest, best way to make journalism sustainable through money moving forward.
Well, I'll take off some of what you said and go in a different direction, because you did mention that, you know, commercial newsrooms are shrinking. And with that, I think we are losing people who create content who are people of color. And I want to know what you think about content creation in the future. Should we be looking at who's creating the content and what audiences we're creating content for? Anybody?
I can say that I've seen WDET in Detroit do some community engagement where they've brought together independent journalists and community members who want to learn how to tell stories in a more journalistic fashion. And so they've done a lot of community events. They've done training of community members to help them sit in and at least harvest the information so that it can be reported, so it freed up some of their dollars for their reporters, and then just having the community members come from their perspective, extract the data, and then give it to the reporters who are then shape the story. That's one of the ways that I've seen there be some community engagement, some freeing up the resources, and then we have some kind of input into how the stories are being told. So I'm not sure of how far that model is going to go or how long or how sustainable, but I think that that's a great step in the right direction.
Yeah. Emmett, you could probably talk more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I know for us, we're a magazine that since the beginning has been charged with reporting on the world and all that's in it. But quite frankly, up until a few years ago, it was reporting on the world and all that's in it by white guys. And so in the last few years, Susan Goldberg, our editor, has made it her sort of raison d'etre, her mission in life, to fix that. And we're making strides. We're not where we need to be, but we're headed in the right direction, because I don't think you can cover an interconnected world today that, you know, everyone has Twitter and Facebook, or many people have Twitter and Facebook, and it's very connected, without acknowledging the fact that everyone has blind spots. And if you're not having these stories about the world told by all of the sort of myriad perspectives and positions of the world, that you're only telling one tiny little sliver of the story. And so while, you know, we are very much focused on delivering those stories to a mass audience, we're being far more, I think, cognizant today about who is telling those stories and what voices that we're bringing into the magazine and onto our website to tell those stories than we ever have. And that, to me, is vitally important, because we are an outlet where millions of people learn about the world, and they can't just learn about it from guys that look like me.
I was just going to say, you know, I think examining the model of how commercial newsrooms are shrinking is in itself kind of a backwards way of looking at this, because as commercial newsrooms realize there's been change, they're evolving also. And so in the process, we don't think of ourselves as a TV station. You say the word newsroom as though we're the 1980s newsroom. All of us are hanging out, and getting pizza on election night and covering the news and hoping everyone's watching TV. That's not where we're at. We look at our newsroom more of we're a media company, all right? So I'm a reporter at a media company. I produce content on different platforms. Most people probably see the platform on TV. Secondly, they see it on their phone, and then they see it perhaps on their tablet or elsewhere. The thing that I think is interesting is that when people come at it from the model of like, oh, there's a traditional newsroom, we're missing the point of the evolution that's happening in these huge commercial newsrooms. And so we're owned by News Corp. And by the way, I always have to explain this to everybody. You know, we're owned by News Corp. So News Corp owns 21st Century Pictures. So you watch movies by News Corp. You read magazines by News Corp. And then, of course, you know there's Fox News that's owned by News Corp. And then there's another whole unit called Fox Television Stations, not operated by Fox News. When people see Fox 2, they say, oh, you're Fox News. And they don't care to try to understand, even when I explain often, because they're defensive. You know, they assume something, and now you're telling them they're wrong, and they get upset. But Fox Television Stations is actually completely operated by local managers. So my news director is from Grosse Pointe, Michigan. My assistant news director is from Northville. I'm from Troy. You know, and so there's leadership that comes from within that lives there. the newsroom does have to reflect and look like the society that it's covering. And I think even those big commercial newsrooms, in the evolution of understanding that we're not just a TV station, we're a media company, understands when we put out content, this Indian American and other people can put out content that goes on Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere. And we have 345,000 people on Twitter who are watching my story links go out and other people. So you hope that we're reaching those as well.
So yeah, let's get more audience questions. We want quick questions with quick answers.
Okay. So I'm Mark Schlefstein with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. I'm going to make a statement and hope that you guys will respond to it. And that is this. As a newspaper reporter in a dramatically reduced newsroom, I have found that it is my responsibility to fundraise for positions in the newsroom. And events like this are perfect opportunities to do that, because I know that there are people in the audience who have money and the ability of making that money available to news organizations, whether it's for environment journalism, which I would hope they would do, or other things. And I think it's our responsibility as reporters, every place that there's a microphone, to be doing exactly what I'm doing right now. And I guess what I'm asking is, how do you guys figure out ways of getting reporters to be responsible for the fundraising that is necessary for us to continue to do our jobs?
So yeah, public service announcements, please subscribe to your local newspaper. No, but I do think it is increasingly becoming part of our, you know, responsibility as journalists to evangelize for journalism and the importance of journalism and the importance of paying for journalism. I don't know that we would go to a model where reporters had to sell subscriptions like Girl Scout cookies, but... Yeah, don't give them any ideas. But how much do you feel, as journalists, the pressure to sell journalism?
Okay. I don't know.
In our newsroom, the only thing that... This is going to be a shitty answer, but the only thing that we can do in our newsroom, the only thing that we do in our newsroom is try to create impact and then talk about that impact on a regular basis. We've done these stories and we've changed these laws. I've worked in other places where we have gone to events where the reporters who are on the radio or some of the more marquee reporters will talk about their reporting to donors or to folks in this hope that they will also give money. I do think that increasingly there the line between the business side and the reporting side is starting to be more porous. And I think being open to some of these ideas on how the paper or the website or whatever it is does make money, it does help round out a reporter in a different way. That is not to say that reporters should, I mean, I don't know. This is not to say that reporters will ever probably be fundraisers, but I do think that there are benefits to understanding how things work and being involved in some of those sort of like, what is that engagement funnel from story to subscription to donor to advertiser. Okay. But again, I don't have a checklist for you, though.
I think we have one more audience question, so we can get...
There's two, but I don't know if we could just quickly spell out our questions, and then you could just close out the answers with the two questions. Just so you get the two questions on the floor.
I'm not asking a question.
Oh.
I'm just manning the microphone.
Okay. Andy Revkin, New York Times for a long time, National Geographic Society, the nonprofit part, the grant-making part now. I'm wondering, now that I'm in my 60s and have seen this transition and participated in it, from authority journalism, that's the way it is, to engagement reporting, which I saw at ProPublica is amazing. But I still wonder if we're holding on to a model that's going to feel really antiquated 10 years from now, which is that we have this authority. It's still kind of an authority model. Everyone in this room, including me, feels like we know how to shape accountability better than anyone else, as opposed to, is there any role for the people in this room in just advancing the communal capacity to impose transparency where it's needed and communicate effectively when there's a problem? And there's two great quick examples, but I can bring them up, but I'd rather hear from you
all. Talk about the communal responsibility.
Do we have a role to give tools to community?
I think Tawana...
Document Cloud.
Yeah. You're in a unique position to speak to that, working with trying to educate people about how to use technology and media tools.
I'm really grateful for your question, first of all. I think that, if I look around the room right now, it's very intimidating to come from the community perspective. And so right now, media is very consumer and producer oriented. Like the community is the consumers of the media instead of being the producers, because the content comes from what we extract from community members. And so there has to become a way that community can become more intricately involved in the narrative of thinking of what media and news is. Because right now, it's always going to be that dynamic unless we think about it as this is the fruit of the stories that we're producing, and how do we do it in a collaborative way. And if there are community members that maybe aren't up to speed, understanding the ideas, understanding the technology, then what is our role and responsibility to keep the media, because the most important thing is keeping the information flowing, right? And I think that everyone who produces information and technology and news feels that way. So then how do we bring up people up to speed so that they can understand and produce content and then become supporters financially in resourcing these news media outlets and things? So the reasons why things like quote-unquote fake news can run is because people have become disconnected from their responsibility in producing media. They feel like the media is just extracted about them, and the narrative isn't always in a positive light. And so we have a responsibility, and I'm saying we, as someone who produces content and information for my community, we have a responsibility to try and collaborate and find ways that we can bring community members into the ownership of the production of news, and so that they are not just they're not consumers and being extracted for the information that we're producing. And so one of the ways, like I said earlier, is Census 2020 is a perfect example. It's going to be mostly online. Well, I referenced earlier that 38% of the city Detroit doesn't have access to the internet. Then what is my responsibility to bring community members into a space where they can still be counted, essentially? And so then we're going to organize those tech fairs. We're going to bring in the experts, whether it be a media person, a technologist, a city government person, so that we can collaborate on how we get that information out to everyone. And so I just think that now we have an opportunity in a social media age, and as we're thinking about the future of news, on how we can become community members together collectively, because all of us are community. We live somewhere. And so we have to be thinking in that way.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask one last question before we close this panel. I kind of going to feed off of what Terry was saying about Wired declaring the end of everything. was Emmett. Okay.
Emmett.
Sorry, white guys. No. Emmett saying, if there is something that you think we're doing now as media organizations or media consumers or, media researchers that we won't see in 20 years, I hope Twitter goes up in a fiery ball, but that's just me. But what would you think that we won't be doing in 20 years that we are doing now? I'll start at the end. Ooh. Hope we won't.
I'd take a page from Terry's book. I don't know. So I think it's really difficult to predict. Think back 20 years, right? How did we do news then? How did we do communication then? How did people find information then? It was very different from what we're living today.
But in an ideal world, just one thing you wish that we won't be doing 20 years from now.
I hope they're still thinking critically about news. Right? So I think in 20 years, it's going to be much, much harder to distinguish between what is real news and what is fake news, because we're already at a stage where it's relatively easy to doctor photos, to doctor videos, to make people say whatever you want to make them say, right? It's kind of like the dark sides of AI, I guess. And at the same time, I think we have this filtering aspect as well, right? So right now we're in an era where people are kind of living in filter bubbles, and they're consuming news that are just reinforcing their held positions rather than actually engaging or often engaging in actual conversation.
Yeah. Terry, what do you hope we won't be doing in 20 years?
I hope that we as reporters stop thinking that everything we do is so precious and new, and understand that what we're talking about, many organizations have been doing this already. Organizing, marketing, academic research. This is all to say that I hope that we don't think that way and we start working more collaboratively with folks outside of our industry to do this type of work. I do think what Allied Media does is probably some of the most interesting community information work that is happening out there today. City Bureau in Chicago is doing some very interesting, beautiful things. So I think that we are not thinking of that we are, you know, precious and in a castle and on a wall and just telling people what they need to know, but we're working with folks more collaboratively, more porously, and that it is you know, we're all very happy and rich and wealthy. And
Emmett,
I'm just kidding. I hope we're all poor.
What won't we be doing, or what do you hope we won't be doing in 20 years?
I mean, that's a hard question to answer, because 20 years ago, I think, you know, most newspapers thought the internet was this fad that was going to go away. And then when it didn't, they decided to just give everything away on it, which has sort of led us here. But in 20 years, I sort of assume it will all very much be different. All the platforms will be different. You know, we may still have, you know, half a dozen print newspapers, a few magazines. We may not. We may have as many as we do now. All that's going to change. I hope what doesn't change is that we find ways through nonprofits, through profits, because any way you fund journalism is a good way. There is no better way, best way. They're all good. That we keep people digging into the stories that are going untold and we find ways to tell those.
Tawana?
I hope that we're practicing a more consentful form of media and technology, and that we are coexisting in a healthy data, digital, technological media ecosystem where everyone feels respected and appreciated for the information that they share.
Rube?
Yeah, I think we got to follow the flow. I think storytelling has been around since the beginning of time. As human beings, we crave the truth. We want to know the truth. And I think we're smart enough to decipher, often more so than we think, that the audience is smart enough to think and understand what's real and what's fake. I think they will start trusting the people they trust, and whoever those people they trust, they'll have more power to tell the stories. But I think the way we look at how to tell stories has to evolve. I think the bottom line for me is, if you're a storyteller, find the platforms that are out there. As those platforms change, you have to change along with them.
Thank you. What a great panel, right? Thanks so much, you guys.